Welcome to PROTECT, Suicide Prevention Training Podcast for Healthcare Professionals. I'm Manan, consultant psychiatrist, founder, and head of faculty at Progress Guide.
Good day. This is Mahi, your host. We are on to episode 16. We began the SES module in episode 13. Manan provided an overview, and we started looking at attitudes to suicide and why awareness regarding where one stands is so important in terms of care delivery. In episode 14, we went deeper into the first chapter of Assess, Appraise Decisions, and began the WHERE framework. We discussed the impact of anxiety on decision making and how assessments have a dual role, the overt stated one, i.e. to assess, and the subtle implied one, i.e. to contain the crisis, and how these two functions can be at cross purposes, and how anxiety of unearthing things that are difficult to contain may get in the way of a full thorough exploration. In episode 15, we built on this concept further and discussed two mental spaces, rational and rationalizing. So rational is information first, decision later, and rationalizing is decision first, followed by selection of information to support the decision or action. Manan, you believe this is the key insight from the WHERE study.
Absolutely. Awareness of these two mental operating spaces is critical in gaining a greater understanding of what influences clinical decisions. They play out through all five aware factors. By the end of the aware framework, listeners will realize that rational versus rationalizing is the glue that holds the five factors together.
I love the diagram in the PROTECT book of those faceless people. The rational professional looks at all the jigsaw pieces and makes the decision, and the rationalizing clinician makes their decision and then points out specific pieces from the jigsaw puzzle that supports their decision while neglecting the rest.
Yes, my colleague and co-author of the AWARE paper, Dr. Chiara Lombardo, absolutely loves that image. She was the one who did most of the thematic analysis of the assessor interviews, and she says that the image captures what she was noticing in the answers given by professionals. You know, the answers that they gave post-assessment as to why they decided to send someone home or why they decided to admit someone into hospital. They had made their decision quite early in the process, and then they zeroed in on information that supported their decision.
If you don't know where to access the images, they're available at the podcast blog. You will also find the show notes, the key messages, and the messages and images. Also, you can get the PROTECT guidebook from Amazon to read along. I keep reinforcing that the images are particularly helpful for visual learners and help with retention. We have worked hard to make the PROTECT training as intuitive as possible to aid with retention, and images and acronyms are all part of that concept retention process that we pay a lot of attention to in the live or online training. Also, do not forget to subscribe and rate us on Spotify or Apple Podcast. Share the episode on LinkedIn and Twitter. It helps us get the word out. Also, do send through questions, topics, and guest interview suggestions to admin@progress.guide. Okay, let's get started with the crux of episode 16, the next aware factor, waiting.
Yes, waiting is the second theme in aware. The presence or absence of certain factors made assessors view suicidal distress in different light. So these factors were diagnosis, like suicidality in people with personality disorder and substance misuse counted for less. Course of illness, acute presentations trumped chronic ones, and finally, social factors, which were considered to be outside the core remit of mental health work, seemed to count for less when that was involved in the genesis of suicidality.
So, let's begin with diagnosis. You were saying that suicidality in certain diagnosis counted for less.
So if you kept those two mental spaces in mind, one rational and one rationalizing, a rational observation of suicidality would have revealed similar or even higher risk due to having a personality disorder and or substance misuse issues. But what we found in the AWARE study was that somehow risk was minimized in the assessment process, and patients with these diagnoses were provided comparatively less intensive support options, and were often referred back to their referrers for ongoing support or encouraged to engage with their current community supports or referred to onto other agencies outside secondary care, in effect getting less care when the level of suicidality they had might have been quite similar.
And the comparator here is those who are clinically depressed without personality disorder and or substance misuse?
Yes, and also other conditions like depression in someone with, say, schizophrenia or depression with someone in a bipolar condition. The thematic analysis reveals statements like, he's a cannabis user, which he uses to self-medicate with his anger difficulties. We gave him advice on alcohol, making him impulsive, but what else can we do?
This is in response to queries about why they might have not been admitted or taken on for home treatment.
Yes, and the degree of suicidality might have been similar. In fact, the risk is higher if you look at severe personality disorder. That has a standardized mortality ratio from suicide of 45.1, highest amidst all the diagnostic groups. This is in comparison to 19.7 for depression. Yet statements like, she has a borderline personality disorder and is on the waiting list for MBT in the community. That is going to be the mainstay of treatment. What is to be gained by a short stint in home treatment or an admission? You know, these statements were very common, but the risks of life lost through suicide are actually higher because of the personality disorder.
What is MBT?
I should have mentioned mentalization-based treatment. I was just reading from the script of one of the interviews. We had invested quite heavily in mentalization-based treatment, in short, MBT, training for staff in the community personality disorder pathway in Cambridge. And that was one of the main therapeutic options on offer. In essence, what they were saying was not incorrect. Longer-term therapy was the answer. But what about short-term support? The question kept coming back. Did the diagnosis influence the actual clinical decision not to take someone on for short-term support, like for home treatment, or to admit them for a crisis admission?
You also mentioned substance misuse. How does the standardized mortality rate for suicide in people who are using substances compare with depression?
It is different for each substance. For opioid use, it is 13.5. It is lower than 19.7 of depression, but 13.5 is still quite high. It is comparable to that of lung cancer from smoking. But suicidality in people using substances often counted for less. This may relate to frequent presentations at A&E or even a separation in the UK between mental health care and addiction services. Over the last 15 years, contracts for addiction services have gradually gone to the NGO sector, and there is this artificial divide between mental health care and addiction support.
And do patients often fall in between?
Yes, absolutely. You end up having a system that where parts of the system go, oh, not mine, yours. And the other part goes, no, not mine, yours. So for those with dual diagnosis and most in need, instead of having a service that is step up, essentially you get a step back service. Everyone says, not mine. One of the joys of working in the NHS is how integrated the care is across the primary-secondary divide. I cherish that every day now that I do not enjoy the same luxury in Australia where primary care and secondary care are not as integrated. But in the UK, care for those with dual diagnosis has become fragmented by taking addiction services away from the NHS. Not to mention the impact of that on the training of future addiction psychiatrists and nurses, etc. Anyway, I am digressing. As you can see, I have very strong views on the split between mental health care and addictions. And I feel that had a part to play in the weighting of symptomatology we noticed in the AWARE study in those with substance misuse problems and concurrent suicidality. In fact, both for personality disorder and substance misuse, the risk of death through misadventure, impulsivity, and repeat attempts is far greater than those with just straightforward depression.
In the waiting theme after diagnosis, the next sub-theme you mentioned was course.
Yes. We found that an acute presentation where there has been a step change trumped acute on chronic, which trumped chronic presentations. The clinical reality is that people who have been chronically unwell or have been unwell for a while start to lose touch with hope and could be at as much risk or even higher risk than those who get acutely unwell. Because you start thinking, I have tried this, I've tried that, and nothing helps me. But somehow acute risk, in terms of suicidality, seem to get far greater priority in terms of care allocation.
Was there a relationship between the diagnosis and course?
That is a legitimate question, as often people with personality disorder and alcohol misuse or substance use have ongoing risk and present repeatedly or frequently in crisis to A&E or emergency departments. One can see why there might be a degree of desensitization to the risk with which they are presenting due to the chronicity on display. In short, yes, when there is an acute escalation in risk, the assessors felt the need to do something definitive. But for chronic risk, particularly those presenting with substance misuse or personality disorder, there was a sense of not much has changed. Why now?
What kind of statements did you get in the qualitative analysis?
So for acute risk, we had statements like, she was presenting as quite labile, was quite unsettled, agitated, disinhibited. We have to do something. Now you can feel that sense of urgency in this kind of statement. But for chronic risk, we had statements like, I didn't think it was an appropriate referral. He has long-term ongoing problems. More could have been done by the locality team before referring. You can hear the two contrasting approaches. In acute risk, you hear it. We need to do something now. But in chronic risk, it is someone else's responsibility. Why are they being referred to the most expensive bit of the system? You know, the most expensive bit of the system's job is to deal with those who are most acutely unwell. But there is very little thinking given to saying, when has this chronic risk gone past a threshold that something definitive needs to happen?
Essentially, you are saying that there is a natural predisposition in crisis professionals to take more seriously acute presentations, but that it is important to remember that people who have been chronically unwell may have completely lost touch with hope and might feel more trapped than those who are acutely unwell, and that risk needs to be taken seriously.
In the actual PROTECT training, we run case study simulations on a model of suicidality called STEPS, in which we take trainees through the different stages of predisposition, ideation, intention, action, contemplation in post-action, repeat action, and back into life in motion with a safe recovery. Now, we'll talk about this in detail in a future episode as to how static, stable, dynamic, and fluid factors interact. However, one thing that always stands out for me is how limited an understanding participants have of the different approaches that need to be taken for acute risk, chronic risk, and acute on chronic risk.
Can you tell us more about these different approaches?
It's a bit difficult to explain without the STEPS diagram. I guess listeners can imagine a tiered system of progression or look at the blog for the STEPS diagram. So, as I said, we'll talk about this later on as well in a future episode when we'll discuss the progression of suicidality from ideation to intention to action. But please remember that it is not sequential in real life and people fluctuate all the time between these tiers. But say for illustration purposes, if you're dealing with acute risk, that involves someone going in a very short period of time from life in motion or predisposition through to ideation, intention formation, and or action. So a sudden peaking of risk. Now, our response to this needs to be like a response that we would have for someone who is having a myocardial infarction.
So taking definitive steps, like in a patient with chest pain having a heart attack.
Yes, so jump in and do what needs to be done. In chronic risk though, like someone with personality disorder or chronic depression, their suicidality may be going along with minor fluctuations going in between ideation and intention and sometimes speaking into action. Now, every time they present in crisis, it will be inadvisable to admit them into hospital. The response to them, however, needs to be equally thorough, but is qualitatively different to the one of a patient having a heart attack. I think of them as patients who have a severe diabetic illness, and they need rigorous support to help them stay on top of their diabetes. A lot of that is self-monitoring and self-regulation, taking adequate insulin, eating appropriately, avoiding hypoglycemic states, getting adequate wound care if they get a cut, and so on.
So, for chronic risk, rigorous support like in severe diabetes, but care that is primarily led by the person, and the person has to take charge of their recovery.
Yes. So we draw on the person's internal coping strategies, help them understand that suicidal urges come in waves. Every time they use an internal coping strategy successfully, they learn that these urges can be mastered. So the focus is very much on learning distress tolerance. There may be a temptation to rationalize the risk away as low or non-existent, as not much has changed. But people with chronic risk need rigorous safety planning, particularly as it is more likely that they would be managed in the community and will be on their own. So a lot of work, and maybe even more work, needs to go into chronic risk management than acute risk management, where you step in and take control.
And this additional work is to prevent people with chronic risk tipping into suicidal action, assuming if you are in that ideation intention tier of the STEPS model, it will not take much to tip one over into a full-blown crisis.
That is exactly correct. Understanding triggers, early warning signs, when to use internal coping strategies, when to use external coping strategies, when has it become a crisis, when is it an emergency? So clarity over what to do, when, and with whom is essential. So a lot of work involved in mitigating chronic risk is just like supporting people with severe diabetes, where education forms a big part of the support.
So for acute risk, deliver care like you would for someone having a heart attack. And for chronic risk, deliver care for someone with severe diabetes. Now, what about presentations which are acute on chronic?
Put simply, this is like caring for those with a severe diabetes in the midst of a heart attack. So they really should be the top of your response list. But unfortunately, if you're not able to differentiate acute on chronic risk from chronic risk, one is bound to take the wrong approach. That is why it is so important to predefine in a person-centered way for each individual what does acute on chronic look like for them. So someone who self-harms, it might be that their frequency of self-harming goes up from once or twice a week to daily, or they go from self-harming on the concealed parts of their body to self-harming on their neck or their face, or their cuts are getting quite deep and are no longer superficial. This discussion needs to be undertaken when the person is calm, and it's almost like an advanced directive for care delivery. So care should be pre-planned for these situations. In my experience, designing the safety net actually decreases the frequency of such crisis occurring.
I know that you talk about this kind of ultra-high risk scenarios in the suicide prevention training for GPs and primary care professionals.
Yes, we run a training program called LIFE for primary care staff, mainly GPs. Now, we have to remember that they are the ones who often deal with a lot of the chronic risk, you know, the ongoing risk in the community when people have had their interventions in secondary care and they come back to primary care, but their risk hasn't completely subsided. Now, this workup needs to be done when the going is good, because then it provides clear trigger points of when to escalate back into secondary care for short-term intensive crisis support. And then when the difficult period subsides, they can return back to primary care. Supporting people with personality disorder is a challenge even in secondary care. So you can imagine how difficult it is in primary care where you just have 10-minute appointments. But remember, it is a sequence of 10-minute appointments. That is what management of chronic risk involves. And if one or two of those 10-minute appointments are utilized in forward planning, a lot of risk can be managed, mitigated, and addressed.
This has been a really informative and an in-depth discussion on the course of illness. Acute risk, remember heart attack. chronic risk, remember severe diabetes, acute on chronic risk, think heart attack in a person with severe diabetes.
And make sure that there is clarity on how you will spot the heart attack in a person with diabetes. I feel we've gone off at a bit of a tangent from the aware factors.
But it was important to understand the different approaches, or else people might just rationalize away chronic risk as low risk, rather than do the safety planning workup that is needed. Have we covered the course of the illness discussion?
Yes, I think we have.
Then I think that brings us to the third of the sub-themes in waiting, social factors.
Yes, responding to suicidal crisis emanating from social factors like relationship breakdown, financial difficulties, accommodation issues, employment difficulties, family or carer availability seem to be quite low on the priority of the assessors. Suicidality in people with a clear-cut biological illness like depression or bipolar disorder was taken far more seriously than in those where suicidality was a result of feeling overwhelmed by life circumstances which were generally social in nature.
Why do you think that was?
This is speculative, but in my honest opinion, my feeling was that the assessors did not consider responding to a social crisis as part of the remit for mental health care staff. There was a strong feeling that we are here to treat mental illness, not deal with social crisis.
Did that come out in the thematic analysis?
Yes, there were statements like, social support impacted the decision-making, no significant friends or family, she receives no support from care services with regard to her son, she's single, financially lacking, and on benefits, lacking social support. She has physical illness with a lot of symptoms, but not really for us. The degree of suicidality may be quite similar to someone with depression, but suicidality emanating from a social crisis seemed to count for less in terms of a mental health response, whether that be an admission or home treatment support. Generally, onward referrals were made to non-health or non-statutory sector, which in many cases were appropriate as the practitioners were trying to remedy the cause of the problem.
To bring all of this together, what should professionals do to stay in the rational space and respond appropriately, rather than rationalize away risk as low or not much has changed?
Well, we'll keep coming back to awareness through reflection and reflective practice. One needs to be aware of prejudices they hold regarding certain diagnoses. Also, they need to remain mindful of chronically unwell people, losing touch with hope. Finally, social factors are modifiable, and addressing them proactively can help resolve the crisis quite effectively.
So, pause and think. Do you take suicidality less seriously in certain diagnostic groups? Do you take suicidality less seriously if there is not a step change in presentation? Do you take suicidality less seriously if they are overwhelmed by social problems? Become aware of your prejudices.
There is also the bit that we discussed about how acute and chronic risk trumps all other kinds of risk and the different approaches that one takes to acute, chronic, and acute on chronic risk.
Yes, I absolutely love the metaphor of responding to a heart attack, building self-management skills in someone with severe diabetes, and then rapid detection and response to a heart attack in a person with severe diabetes.
That's actually quite a wonderful summary. So all three sub-themes, a diagnosis of personality disorder and a substance misuse, chronic course, and a range of social challenges may exist in the same individual. Now, each one of these factors that actually increase risk, and the risk may not be just additive, it may be multiplicative. But in your mind, somehow, due to their diagnosis, chronic cause, and social causation, if you are just seeing more reasons for why a mental health response is not warranted at this point in time, you can see how someone who is perilously close to taking their life may be left unsupported.
That is an even better summary and a sobering thought to end episode 16 on. Today we have looked at waiting, the second aware factor, and the different approaches to acute, chronic, and acute on chronic risk. Pause and think. How might this knowledge bring progress to your practice? When was the last time you assessed someone in whom these factors might have been at play. Did these factors influence your decision in any way? Did you stay in the rational space and notice all the factors, the overall escalating risk in the individual, and then make a judgment call, or just noticed each factor on its own and used it to justify why a crisis response was not warranted? Watch out for them at the next assessment. How do you respond to those with a personality disorder or those who are presented 3 times that week intoxicated to the emergency department? Do you find yourself saying in your thoughts, "Oh well, not much has changed since the last presentation"? Pause and think, are you talking about chronic risk and then keep presenting because no one has actually done the necessary safety planning work needed to manage chronic risk? What about social factors? Do you consider these modifiable factors as part of your core remit or not? The social determinants of health are such an important pillar of suicide prevention work. What should be your contribution? Share your musings with us. Tweet your thoughts about waiting and tag #GuideProgress. It helps get the word out about the podcast to more professionals and supports progress to practice. You can email your thoughts to us at admin@progress.guide with your suggestions and comments, particularly if you have questions and want us to cover certain topics in the discussion. In the next episode, we will go through the remaining factors in the WHERE framework. You can access all the information at www.progress.guide. You can connect with Manan on LinkedIn or follow our LinkedIn page by searching on LinkedIn for progress.guide. We are also on Twitter and YouTube. Our Twitter handle is @GuideProgress. As usual, please do follow the podcast. There'll be weekly episodes every Friday and share it with your colleagues. Your ratings will help get the word out, so please don't forget to rate us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or Audible, or whichever channel you are listening on. Helping healthcare professionals become aware of their decision-making processes is an essential step in creating a workforce that is self-aware. Remember, together we can make a difference. Tune in next Friday and we'll explore how perceived agendas impact clinical decision-making and, depending on time, the rest of the WHERE framework. Thank you for joining us today, and keep spreading the word.